Welcome to ScotusCast, Litigation Costs and Debt Collection Disputes Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On February 26, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Marks v. General Revenue Corp., which concerns the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, or FDCPA, and the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. The FDCPA authorizes a judge to award costs and reasonable attorney's fees to a defendant if the judge determines that the plaintiff brought his or her FDCPA lawsuit in bad faith and for the purpose of harassing the defendant. The question marks was whether, when there is no finding of bad faith or harassment, a prevailing defendant in an FDCPA can nevertheless obtain an award of costs under the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure 54D, which generally allows an award of costs, but not attorney's fees, to a prevailing party in civil litigation, unless the federal statute, these federal rules, or court order provides otherwise. In an opinion delivered by Justice Thomas, the court held by a vote of 7-2 that the FDCPA does not conflict with Rule 54D, and that a district court therefore retains discretion to award costs to a prevailing defendant without having to find that the plaintiff brought the case in bad faith and for the purpose of harassment. Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, and Alito joined Justice Thomas's majority opinion. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion, which was joined by Justice Kagan. To discuss the case, we have Charles Keckler, who serves on the Board of Directors of the Legal Services Corporation. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Keckler.
In a 7-2 decision, the Supreme Court recently decided the case of Marks versus General Revenue Corporation. Justice Thomas wrote for the majority, and Justice Sotomayor wrote a pointed dissent, joined by Justice Kagan. There were no concurring opinions. The court was asked to examine the interaction of two rules that relate to the payment of court costs, Rule 54 of the Rules of Civil Procedure, and Section 1692K of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. These rules indicate the extent to which a losing litigant will be responsible for paying, for example, his or her opponent's witness and transcription fees. Under the American rule, attorney's fees are assumed to be borne by the party incurring them, regardless of case outcome. But other costs can shift based on the litigation, and that is what these rules cover. Rule 54 is the default rule. It applies in all civil litigation in federal court, and in relevant part states that unless a federal statute, these rules, or a court order provides otherwise, costs, other than attorney's fees, should be allowed to the prevailing party. At the most basic level, then, the claim of the petitioner, Olivia Marks, joined by the Solicitor General and ultimately reflected in Justice Sotomayor's dissent, is that Section 1692 of the FDCPA is a, quote, federal statute that provides otherwise and thus trumps Rule 54 under its own terms. They then interpret the operation of Section 1692K as not permitting assignment or taxation of costs to Marks, who lost her case in district court in Colorado to the General Revenue Corporation. Obviously, General Revenue Corporation disagrees, claiming that 1692 is inappropriate in the circumstances of this case, that Rule 54 governs, that Marks lost, and that she needs to pay up. Specifically, that she owes them $4,543.03, which is what the trial court allowed and ordered her to pay after GRC submitted a bill of costs for about $7,800. The case arose because Marks got herself in trouble with some student loans. She was going back to school to get certified as a medical assistant to help support herself and her kids. She says she thought the funds received were grants, but in any event, they weren't, and she ended up in default. She's struggling, behind on her rent, trying to get the kid's dad to pay child support, barely making ends meet, and there's no way, she says, that she can service these loans. GRC, who bought the debt off the educational loan issuer, was, again, she says, calling her up several times a day, threatening to garnish half her already rather meager wages, and giving helpful suggestions, like perhaps she could go and sell her blood to make payments. They also sent a fax requesting information to her workplace. Marks, distressed, sued GRC under the FDCPA, which forbids various debt collection practices that amount to undue harassment of the debtor. She took her case all the way to a bench trial in federal court, but the judge ultimately decided that her recollection of the phone conversations was flawed and that the facts didn't violate any provision of the statute. However, nobody argues here that Marx brought the action in bad faith or that she didn't have a case. Her case was simply weaker at trial. The FDCPA has its own provisions relating to costs, and it is really on the varying interpretation of what these provisions do and don't say that the strictly legal issue depends. The first sentence of 1692K(a)(3) provides that plaintiffs, if they win, get their attorney's fees and their costs reimbursed by the debt collector. This kind of provision is not uncommon. For consumer protection or civil rights statutes, potential damages may be small and plaintiffs may be poor. This one-way abrogation of the American rule both finances the case and creates a cost deterrent for defendants. But only, of course, if plaintiffs are successful, and Marx wasn't. One thing to note, the statute gives plaintiffs costs if they win. But wouldn't they get them anyway under Rule 54? You can argue this both ways. On the one hand, you could suggest Congress really was abrogating Rule 54, but putting back in costs to protect any successful plaintiffs, i.e., but not defendants. Or you can argue that it's just a belt and suspenders kind of thing, and that's the view that prevailed. You're getting fees and costs, so nobody has to wonder if you get costs as well as the fees. The subsequent sentence is where the real action is in the statute. This provides that the court may award the defendant's attorney's fees and costs if it finds the action was brought by the plaintiff in bad faith and for purposes of harassment. The capacity to award such a remedy for bad faith actions is generally considered within a court's inherent powers, so arguably this provision is a little redundant as well. What's most important here is what the statute doesn't say. It doesn't say anything about costs or fees if the defendant prevails, but there has been no finding of plaintiff malfeasance. That provides the nub of the corporation's winning argument. The FDCPA doesn't expressly provide for what you do when a defendant wins, but the action wasn't in bad faith, and that's the situation that pertains in this case. Hence, the FDCPA doesn't, quote, provide otherwise, in the words of Rule 54, for an instance like this, and must yield to the default rule, loser pays costs. Marx's argument that the FDCPA does in fact provide otherwise is based on congressional intent, and her first method of inferring this intent uses the classic statutory interpretation canon against superfluity. Congress included the term and costs here. If Congress had assumed Rule 54 was operative, these words would be redundant. Therefore, to make every word count, the argument goes, you read Rule 54 out. Justice Thomas's response is that given that the right to award fees and costs for bad faith would exist regardless, the statute is redundant any way you look at it. So this canon against superfluity carries relatively little weight. During oral argument, various other justices voiced rather jocular skepticism about the assumption that Congress paid any explicit attention at all to Rule 54 when drafting this statute, thus creating the ambiguities that result in this case. But none of that discussion made it into Justice Thomas's opinion. Marx's second and more sustained argument is based on the idea that Congress's conditioning of defendants' fees and costs on plaintiff bad faith creates a, quote, negative implication that defendants shouldn't have those available otherwise, under the expressio unius exclusio alterius canon. As a matter of formal logic, this has some problems. Discretion for costs is given in the statute in an if-then framework. If P, then Q. If bad faith, then costs. One way to think of Marx's argument is that it is asserting, if not bad faith, then no costs. Or not P implies not Q. As a logical matter, this doesn't follow. It's actually a famous fallacy known as denying the antecedent. P implies Q simply means Q will follow from P, but Q may also arise independently. The court doesn't mind about its P's and Q's here, but it makes this essential point by emphasizing that if Congress had wanted bidirectional implication, it should have constructed a directive of that sort by saying something like, unless bad faith is shown, no costs are to be awarded, or only on a finding of bad faith, the court may award fees and costs. Since logic alone won't generate the exclusio canon, Marx and the Solicitor General have to supplement this by showing through textual or other evidence that, to use the court's language, it is fair to suppose that Congress considered the unnamed possibility and meant to say no to it. Ultimately, the court simply doesn't read the statutory text to suggest this and remains unpersuaded by Marx's view that the FDCPA as a consumer protection statute could not have been intended to weaken the hand of plaintiffs in the way that the corporation is asserting, deterring them from bringing suit for fear of costs. The dissent, following Marx's position, claims that the majority's opinion will, quote, thwart Congress's expectation that the FDCPA would be primarily enforced by consumers. What do we actually know about congressional intent here? Precious little, which accounts for all the cannon fire back and forth. The best that anybody could come up with was a 35-year-old Senate report that suggested the language on bad faith awards was put in as an apparently redundant protection for defendants. A good deal was made of this in briefs, because the inclusion of cost language in this sentence is the basis of the supposed negative implication, and thus would provide, under the theory Marx is operating under, pretty lousy protection if it was so intended. But perhaps because of its rather thin and ambiguous nature, and perhaps because he's reluctant to rely on legislative history here, Justice Thomas doesn't advert to this report at all, and the dissent does so only obliquely in this rather sharp passage. Quoting, "Some members of the majority have expressed doubt about the relevance of legislative history, claiming that relying upon it is analogous to entering a crowded cocktail party and looking for one's friends. But speculating whole cloth about congressional intent, as the majority does, is surely more problematic. The majority saved the trouble of having to look for its friends at the party. It simply invites them." Ouch! The majority and dissent finally get into a dictionary duel over the meaning of the term otherwise in Rule 54. The FDCPA says something about costs other than what is said in Rule 54. That's acknowledged. But is that enough for it to be otherwise? Or does it have to say something contrary to Rule 54, which would require a negative implication the court doesn't believe is present? The court concludes otherwise means contrary, and that the FDCPA isn't contrary, so it isn't otherwise. But at a more fundamental level, it's my impression that this case seems to have come down to a large extent to the relative weight accorded to two different background presumptions. If you strongly presume that the FDCPA is all about consumer protection and should be given maximum effect, you're going to favor Marx's purpose-based argument for congressional intent, as the dissent does. If you think that loser pays costs is a, quote, venerable presumption of our legal system, as Justice Thomas states and to which the dissent objects, you'll want clearer evidence of this being abrogated. In this context, I think it's interesting to observe that it is the two most recent appointees to the court who are on one side in this case, and the seven appointed by prior administrations who are in the majority. If that's not a coincidence, and it's wholly speculative, it's more likely due to something more subtle than simply sympathy with the administration's attorneys. And instead, it might derive from a shared set of background assumptions and beliefs that ultimately end up reflected in how these two presumptions get treated. But I leave that exercise for the listener. Having emerged from the statutory interpretation weeds here, you might pause and question why this case was important enough to warrant treatment by the Supreme Court and accorded vigorous intervention by the United States on behalf of Marx. The opinion does resolve a circuit split with another circuit which adopted Marx's view of the law. Now, don't take that statement out of context, but yes, it was the Ninth Circuit. Nevertheless, although $4,500 is probably a burden for Ms. Marx, made yet more irritating since it's a new debt owed to her debt collector, the fate of the nation might not seem to be implicated. But Justice Sotomayor is probably right that this will affect the way the FDCPA is enforced in a meaningful way. And that is why this case is more important than it might look. Most cases brought under the FDCPA involve low dollar amounts of actual damages. There are statutory damages of up to $1,000 for violations, and occasionally in egregious cases, harassment will result in substantial actual damages, usually under an intentional infliction of emotional distress theory. Generally, though, the economics of these cases are driven by the fact that if plaintiffs win, they get not only damages and costs, but also attorney's fees. The way it usually works is that lawyers, often specializing in this area, take cases on contingency, minimizing risk for the plaintiff, and aim for a settlement, usually in the $2,500 to $7,500 range. If the case goes to judgment, the principal recovery will turn out to be plaintiff's attorney's fees, with a relatively small award to the plaintiff. So, Rule 54 will create major disincentives for most plaintiffs, who are not suing for substantial actual damages, because under the rule they, not the attorneys, might be responsible for the taxable costs. Even if costs amount to only a few $1,000s, this will often transform anything but a slam-dunk lawsuit into an expected loss. At the least, it will make private enforcement of the types of violations normally remedied by statutory damages much riskier personally for the litigant. Nor do FDCPA plaintiffs generally have a few $1,000s to risk, making a moral or legal point. That's why they're being pursued by debt collectors. After this case, the remedy for the potential deterrence of low-value claims would ultimately seem to be either legislative or administrative. If Congress really wants more private enforcement, they could just airdrop the word only into 1692 in front of bad faith, and that would be it. Alternatively, and more likely, the administration could seek to enact an administrative remedy for what are now statutory low-damage violations of the FDCPA, presumably through a scheme centered in the new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, whose interests the Solicitor General was representing in this case. A complaint procedure, particularly one where the CFPB might act against debt collectors once they receive a certain volume of consumer complaints, would almost certainly be more efficient than the current court-based system, would probably protect poor debtors better, and would, at the very least, shield them against the perils of a Rule 54 newly invigorated by the Supreme Court.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.